Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2005. Today's session is Hymn Music as Text Setting, presented by Peter Mercer Taylor in the Fireside Room. Disc number MEP-2005-01. Let's listen in.
And just see what kinds of thoughts immediately come to mind. So pop out that LBW, let's all turn to 245. And sing together the first verse of a hymn, I think, that will be familiar to all of us. All people that on earth do dwell. And again, we'll just do a single verse, maybe last line for an intro.
Okay.
Thank you, Pete. In the context of worship, singing this piece as opposed to speaking this piece, hearing it read perhaps, these words, hearing them read, or perhaps doing them as a kind of congregational utterance, saying them all at the same time. What is the difference? What is accomplished by us singing this instead of just saying it? What's the point of these notes? It's an open-ended question. Fire when ready.
Easier to remember.
Easier to remember. Fantastic. An aid to memory is certainly one thing. Yeah, there's plenty of research about folks whose minds are in various conditions of decay, with Alzheimer's patients and people with various other kinds of degenerative diseases that leave them failing to remember many things. Many folks can be called on to remember the words to songs that they know well when they couldn't recite liturgy or other kinds of things they know at all, or perhaps even their family members' names, that they'll remember words of songs. And in a certain sense, this is obviously symbolically linked with what we all do with liturgical song. It does make it easier to remember words. What else? What do we do singing this that we wouldn't do saying it?
I feel it more.
Feel what exactly? That is what's...
I can cry when I sing a hymn. I don't cry when I say the Lord's... Well, maybe in Lowe's Prayer, but I'm not.
It's not necessarily singing it. It's playing the notes for me that I feel it more.
Okay, and I guess the $64,000 question is, what is the it in that sentence? What do you feel more? I mean, the words you actually feel more, or you simply feel?
The emotion.
The meaning.
Okay, very
Probably
good.
The meaning.
Why do we have some hymns we like better than others?
Some hymns you like
better than others. Why do we like some better than others? And I don't know that answer either, other than they bring to you.
Good. And what else? I mean, any other good reasons to sing this thing? I mean, for the way it makes us feel, obviously it is an extremely important idea. The way it helps us remember.
There's a commonality of everyone doing it together, and it's a communication that comes across.
Good. Fantastic. And a commonality. And if it's a communication, communication takes three things. Somebody speaking, the message itself, being transmitted, and somebody receiving. Who's doing the speaking, who's doing the receiving in this case? I mean, if this is an act of communication, are we communicating, who are we singing to?
It's both. Cohesion.
It's unity,
oneness,
each other,
feeling together.
Okay. We're singing for ourselves almost, or we're singing to God.
Okay. And it's almost as though we're dealing with two things that are fundamentally at odds with one another. On the one hand, we sing because of the way it makes us feel. We sing because, we have daily encounters with music. Music works on us emotionally, and we sing for our own sakes. We sing to ourselves, making ourselves feel a certain way. On the other hand, perhaps we're singing to God. It would appear to be an important question. That is, whether we actually are singing because God wants to hear us or because we want to hear ourselves. What about God wanting to hear us? How do we know God wants to hear us sing?
It says that in the Bible.
It says it in the Bible.
It does.
Yeah. Where does it say it?
I knew you'd ask me that.
I knew somebody would ask me, and I kind of looked up some things this morning.
Now,
where does it say?
Sing to the Lord a new song?
Yes.
Sounds great. Yeah, I mean, you can't
the
swing
clapping
it.
Of the, even the rocks will clap for joy, there's that kind
yeah.
of...
Yeah. And you really can't swing a cat in the Psalms without hitting some reference to sort of singing, though I've just done it. Let's see. That's Psalm 105. Is that a place we find such a thing?
98. I think.
A lot of it's in Revelation.
Yeah. Well, turn the pages fast enough.
98. Sing to the Lord a new song. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And in 105. Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Call on his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing to him. Sing praises to him. Tell of all his wonderful works. And we find this kind of stuff all over the Psalms. Injunctions to sing. This is something God wants us to do. And there's no, make no bones about it. This is how worship is supposed to take place. And in that sense, this is not a small matter. We do it as a kind of common experience. We do it because it feeds into our entire sort of engagement with the liturgical experience. We do it also because God told us to. And this is a very important reason to sing. Not a bad reason at all. Sing praises of God. Other matters. I mean, other things that could be brought to the table here. Yes.
It helps to, it seems to ritualize it. That if we just say it, it seems very common and ordinary, but especially if we gather together to sing, it seems to be more a ritual, a festival, celebration.
Right. Excellent.
When we sing the whole service, we call it it's a high mass, it's a high service. Yeah. When we sing everything. And we don't always sing everything because it takes longer. Mm-hmm. And so if they want to cut up the service shorter, they'll say it rather than sing it, especially the communion service.
Yeah, and certainly in the cases of a mass, I mean, Beethoven can write the words Benedictus qui veni nomine Domini and make them take 6 minutes, 8 minutes, just to get through the single line. Right, it can take a long time to sing stuff. And in a certain sense, this is one way of linking up to the issue of taking off one's shoes. What do you do when you're standing on sacred ground? Well, you've got to do something special. And this is an idea I'm going to return to in several different connections in the course of our conversations this week. But this is one important point of juncture here. You've got to do something special when you're up here saying words of this kind. And this process of ritualization, of sacralization, saying this is a special place we're standing, these are special words we're trotting through, they have to be elevated, they have to be handled with care. Take off your shoes, attend, that is, actually feel the ground under your feet, attend to the words that you're singing here. And this way of sort of calling to attention through the ritualization process and hopefully the sacralization process, obviously singing can certainly help accomplish this. Closing thoughts. Peter, something's on your mind.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it. Unlike speaking, with music there can be harmony, so different voices can be contributing in a different way.
Very good. Very good. Now, how does it broaden that experience? This is a great idea. Nothing makes me happier than the notion of, those of us in the room, for example, being able to get through one of the hymns in the course of today, a cappella, singing four-part harmony. That's very meaningful to me. What it means, I can't quite say. Peter will do a better job. What do you get out of that? Harmonizing. What does it symbolize?
It's just a richness that it brings. And it can also change the emotional flavor. I think in terms of minor keys lending a sadness or a hauntingness, or major keys lending happiness or things like that you can't get from spoken.
Good, good. And I'm not sure we've quite gone there yet, and that brings me to the next big point. That is the question of what's sort of in a minor key, what's in a major key. Mark, is that a thought?
My thought only was, and it only occurred to me now, was that somehow singing things in parts adds a kind of depth to the words, almost as though you've gone from one dimension in saying to multi-dimensions in singing, as with a cube as compared to a flat surface.
Right. And something of symbolic value happens there.
Teamwork. The feeling that you're working together with other people in a cooperative way that expresses the same feelings, the same words, and the same meanings.
Right.
Or pretty much the same, and everybody has their own interpretation. But mm-hmm. We have groups of songs, praise songs, or or communion songs, or, you know, the different parts of the service.
Right, right. Terrific. Yeah. This all makes perfect sense to me. This is a very exciting list to me. I think we're getting close to it. I mean, this to me makes perfect sense as to why there is a value in singing as opposed to not singing. Now, we haven't said much about the specific piece we just sang. What makes this tune work? Any sort of meditations? And maybe this tune doesn't work. I don't know how many of us love this tune. I, for example, don't. I admire this tune in certain ways, but it's not one of those that really hits me in the gut or anything.
Yeah. We use this tune with lots of different words.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, Old 100th. It's one of these old Calvinist psalm tunes that just has kind of managed to survive to this day in several different settings. What about this tune? What makes it work? Anything in particular we could say? Something else that's on your mind?
Yeah, from a musical point of view, it has a movement part and then a slow part. And then a movement part and a slow part. And you see it just looking at the notes, quarter notes and half notes. Quarter notes and half notes, that's consistent.
Right.
That it's a pattern.
Though I must point out that when we sang this as the tune to the grace that we sang yesterday at lunch, at least the second lunch that I got to, we used this tune, and we did it in the isometric version, that is all the sort of longs and shorts ironed out, which is how I grew up singing it. So this is a very, very important point, the fact that the tune works in a certain way in a certain kind of addition. You wouldn't find it rhythmically set this way in a Methodist hymnal. We Methodists don't do things like that. But Lutherans do. You're all over these, the sort of metrically embellished or enhanced or restored versions of these tunes. Many of the kinds of tunes Luther would have known were much more rhythmically vibrant than those that we walked out of the early 18th century with, where people of J.S. Bach's generation ironed out all those sort of rhythmic peculiarities. Then rhythm is a dangerous thing. This is another conversation worth having. But, rhythm is thought to be the most dangerous part of the musical experience from a sort of theological standpoint. The rhythm tends to carry the body forward as opposed to carrying the spirit forward. Many of us grew up in traditions with most things of rhythmic interest sort of taken out of our hymnals. And Lutherans have done a nice job of restoring at least some of them here. That's a great observation. Others, what makes this tune work? Well, there are different things we could say about this tune, and in fact, I'm ready to get away from this tune. But one thing that we could observe, for example, if we're of a musicological bent, we could look back and admire the way that the first phrase takes us down, takes us down that far. The opening note of the phrase is G, and it goes down as far as D. This interval, which spans 1, 7, 6, 5, that is, there are four little notes that you have to give names to span that interval, and we call it a fourth, a very basic sort of musicological concept. Da-da-dum, and it goes up as far as here. But the next phrase goes da-da-da-da-dum, ba-da-dum, and gets us that high. And so we begin with this G. The first phrase takes us a fourth below it. The second phrase takes us a fourth above it. And the third phrase sort of mirrors everything that's happened so far. Dum ba dum takes us up a third. Da dum bum down to the E da dum. Which is to say, it traces the third upward, the third downward. We have this nice little symmetrical thing described in the first two phrases. The same kind of symmetrical pattern captured in the third phrase alone. And then finally a great climax. Da 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 dum. There are perfectly good ways that, from a sort of theoretical standpoint, we could describe why this is a successful tune. That is, why the tune seems engaging and satisfying, and so forth. Now, none of this answers the question that I want to begin talking about this morning. And unhappily, that's where we've arrived here, 15 minutes into our first session. The time is squandered. This isn't what we're here to talk about. That, in a certain sense, this strikes, I think, the normal churchgoer, like myself, this strikes us as the clearest way in which to ponder the question of music. These are the manifestly critical questions, the manifestly important issues in confronting the question of why we take words and attach music to them, or take music and attach words to them. These are the things that obviously matter most. The question I really want to tangle with in the course of this week's discussions are the questions, again, that a musicologist might be interested in bringing to the table. It actually brings an entirely different framework than what in the sort of normal run of the Christian experience seems to be worth bringing up. Because these are the things that are worth bringing up. These are the things that matter, and that matter in a very sort of palpable way. Curiously, when musicologists, when music theorists tend to confront texted music of any kind, there is one central question, and that is the question, how does the music help out the words? Because music has been helping out words for a long time, from about the time of Josquin des Prez, the first sort of Beethoven-level outstanding composer, this towering figure, Josquin, towering figure of the musical Renaissance. He was born probably around 1440, lived to 1521, and through the 1490s, 1500s, and teens, Josquin was putting the stamp on the musical Renaissance. Even Martin Luther himself knew a lot of Josquin's music. Martin Luther said about Josquin, he said, you know, while other composers have to obey the notes obey Josquin. And this is just how it feels, and it's much the experience we have listening to Mozart, as though finally every note is in the right place. You can't see the wheels turning, you don't sense calculations are being made, you simply get the sense that some perfect piece of art has just been kind of plopped there in front of you, and Josquin probably just got it straight from God. And this is how Josquin's music feels to us, contemporary listeners, in a way that perhaps no previous music had. And it was with Josquin's generation, there at the very beginning of the 16th century, that composers began to ask themselves the questions, how can we get beyond Gregorian chant? How can we get beyond the sort of what felt in retrospect like somewhat contrived ways of sticking different melodies together to come up with counterpoint, with these big sort of contrapuntal apparatuses? Music had always seemed a little like a form of architecture, a kind of machinery, where you just tried to stick notes together in such a way that they didn't conflict too badly with each other, and you tried to make everything kind of sort of sound all right at the end of the day, but you didn't really confront the question of how am I going to bring these words to life? It was Josquin's generation who began posing the question, how do we bring words to life? In the 80 years following Josquin's death, the dominant genre of the time, at least the dominant secular genre, was the madrigal. And the madrigal was the first genre in which composers really began to confront that question, how do we get music to communicate what words are communicating? How do we draw an actual link between words and music? So, for example, we have the famous Thomas Weelkes madrigal, as Vesta was from Latmos Hill Descending. And, you know, he begins with the soprano start. You all are going to pity me every time I open my mouth here to sing, but as Vesta was from Latmos Hill descending, from Latmos Hill descending. Now, this is where the sopranos have to begin, and the descending is what gets drawn. The descending gets painted musically. There are many different kinds of things that get painted musically. The big climax of this 6-minute madrigal I just named is a 2-minute segment all on one line, Long Live Fair Oriana. And they just sing this thing over and over and over and over and over again. And the first time the bass sings those words, Long Live Fair Oriana, it sounds like this. Long live fair. That is, he has notes that are 8 measures long. And this is a joke. This is a musical gag. Get it? Long live Fair Oriana. Long notes, long melody, on long makes you live. And this is the way that the 16th century musical imagination began to work. Well, what happens at the end of that century? Opera gets invented. It gets invented in Florence, and suddenly a whole new venue for the communication of meaning in music, which is to say, you've got a character on stage acting out a play in an operatic context, and they have to produce music that will somehow communicate what it is that they're saying. And this is what opera has always been about, of getting the music to tell the story of any particular thing. There's a famous story of a 19th century English operatic translator. And this English translator made his living, so the story goes, made his living translating Italian operas into English. And finally, at some point in mid-career, somebody pointed out to him, yeah, but you don't speak Italian. And the guy said, well, I'm an opera translator. What do you need to know? I love, I suffer, I die. And this is the idea that you didn't have to know Italian.
That's right.
That's right. And you didn't have to know Italian to go to an opera and figure out what was going on. That is, the music told the story. And so there have been many ways at different points in musical history at which music has been seen to tell stories, that the music actually is bound up, inextricably bound up with the words, and that somehow the music does as much of the storytelling work as the words do. And when we come, for example, to John Wesley, founder of Methodism, you know, Wesley, whose brother Charles is one of the great hymn writers in the entire Protestant tradition. You know, John Wesley published several hymnals in his life and was very fond of this sort of unusual practice of publishing hymns with actual tunes in them, as opposed to having these published separately or simply publishing words with the assumption that people would have a common body of tunes they knew. But Wesley was, he was very into thinking of ways in which tunes and words got linked together. But one of his words of advice in one of his early hymnals, he was always sort of laying out sets of rules for pious singing, and one thing he says is, above all, attend to the sense of what you sing. And this is something you have to do at every turn. You can't stop thinking about what those words mean. And I guess the question I want to put before us in the course of this week is, where does Wesley leave us? We talked about this hymn for 15 minutes, and we never attended to the sense of what we sang. We don't remember what those words are about. We can talk about sort of music and how it works for us in a very general sense. We can talk about the specifics of this tune and what makes it work. But at no point did we say, okay, well, how does the music bring the words to life? That is, these words, this word as opposed to that word. How does it make sense of the sense of this tune? How does it participate in the sense-making process? And that's the question I want to pose. And when it comes to hymnody, strangely enough, it's an unlikely question. That is, that it isn't obvious that hymnody as a genre actually does this. It's not obvious that it's a kind of madrigal or a kind of opera, that it's even playing this game of trying to get its words across. It could well be the case that hymnody is something more general than that, or something in which we're just not invited to engage at that level. But sometimes we are. We've talked about Luther and his relationship to Josquin, and the sort of excitement that was building around Josquin's generation and the ability of music suddenly to transmit words. Let's go to a tune that's actually ascribed to Luther on many occasions and give it a sing. You pick up 295, now 50 pages forward in the LBW. With 295, we have a text attributed to Martin Luther and a tune attributed to Martin Luther, which is to say an optimal situation. One guy writing text and tune alike, able to do anything he wants in terms of the relationship between them. And here's what he comes up with. Let's just sing the first verse of this thing.
That's why I made us sing two verses.
Yeah. It's in a minor key, that's right. And in fact, it's not even minor, it's Phrygian of all things. It's an old church mode in which a lot of Gregorian chants take place. Instead of a minor key, which would end, da-da-dum, that would be a minor key. This goes da-da-dum. So there's that little half step right above the tonic note, the sort of central note, which is even more plaintive than the minor key. We only really have one popular hymn in the Phrygian mode. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And we end that thing to da-da-da-da-da-dum. That really is the sort of tonic of the piece. It's Phrygian, it's so sad. And you know, the minor key, or in this case the Phrygian mode, really does that for us. And there's something plaintive, is there not, just about the whole shape of this thing. We just have a lot of sort of descending phrases, the same kinds of things that make O Sacred Head Now Wounded work. Da 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 da. It's just sad, for goodness sake. Just sort of these descending, step-by-step phrases. There are a lot of things like that. What else? First three notes. What do we get in the first three notes?
You're saying, what do you get?
Yeah, and that's right. What does Luther deliver us in the first of four notes? Out of the depths. What have we got?
A depth.
We got a depth. That's right. I mean, I challenge you. You can spend the rest of this session flipping through the LBW to find one other piece that begins that way with such a large dropping gesture. That is a fifth, is what it is. Da 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 da. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Out of the depths. It's right there on the surface. This is exactly what Martin Luther means. There are motets on the same text that do the same thing over and over again. That is other motets that are popular in Luther's lifetime, which do things much like this. People attended to depth, and this is what he means. Out of the depths. That is, we have to see this hymn sort of coming into dangerous contact with the depths in this way. We have to see the tune doing this, encountering the depths, and somehow sort of working against them. It's a very interesting tune in that regard. Now, what we've pointed at, the depths and the minor key, we might as well get this distinction on the table at the outset. These are two very different things that we're talking about happening. And it's a distinction I think it can be helpful to carry forward in these conversations. One has to do with what music does emotionally. That there's something that we might have a very difficult time putting our fingers on about how the minor mode works on us. And we're not going to have that conversation now, because goodness knows where we would get. But there's something about, can I play the piano for a second? There's something about a tune that might go. That is just sadder than a tune. That is just sort of happier in the major mode, sadder in the minor mode. Why is that? Well, goodness knows. But there's something about it that makes it work that way. It works on our emotions, that it's in the minor mode. Now, working on your emotions is one kind of thing. Talking about the depths, da-da-da-da, get it, depths. Talking about depths in this way musically is something else. And in a very casual sense, we can draw a distinction between this sort of emotional baggage. What can we call this sort of thing? The sort of communication of emotion. It's expression that we're talking about, which is to say we have an emotion inside and we express it. We press it outward. An expression is what we're talking about. This thing that comes from within, works its way out. This is expression. This is something totally different. This isn't expressing anything. This is representing something. This is depicting something. And these are two totally different jobs. Representation. These are two totally different jobs that music can take on. The expression of emotions, the kind of capturing of emotion in some kind of very mysterious, murky way that music has of doing it, that's one kind of work music can do. A very different kind is the work of representation, which is to say the Vesta as Vesta was from Latmos Hill descending, and when the descending takes place, when the long live fair Oriana takes place, this is representation. This has nothing to do with emotion. This has nothing to do with music twanging the heartstrings. This is just music trying to paint pictures. And in a certain sense, for the conversation I want to have in the course of this week, this is the more interesting question. That is, we all have a way that music does engage us emotionally somehow. But the question is whether it can do more than that. That is, whether it can, we can get beyond the question, oh yes, this is a sort of pious piece, this is a sort of sad piece, this is a sort of happy piece, this is a joyful piece. Those things obviously are manifestly important. And I think we understand them by the time we're about 8 bars into any hymn we can name. That is, we understand where the emotions are going, how the emotions are being channeled. I think what we tend to talk about less often is this question about representation, about just how music may attend to very particular and sort of corporeal events within a text. And this is really what I'd like to tangle with in the course of this conversation. Martin Luther does it right here, with Out of the Depths. Let's switch to page 31 and see what we get. On page 31, we get another ancient, august Lutheran hymn, Wake, Awake, for Midas Blind.
It doesn't give him the...
What?
It doesn't give him the... It says Philip Nicolai.
Right. Oh, it's right. It's not a Lutheran hymn in the sense of by Luther. I mean, it's in the Lutheran tradition.
A type.
That's right. Yes, and Lutherans love this like nobody else. time is somewhat short. Oh, let's give the whole thing a sing. Let's see if we can just get through a whole verse of this. This, by the way, I don't know if it's true of this hymnal. It's true of the Episcopalian hymnal. This is the longest hymn in the hymnal, the longest tune. That is a sort of note by note. There are more notes in this tune than any other hymn in the Episcopal hymnal. It's a big drink of water. Let's hear it. State the obvious. We're not accustomed to stating this.
Going da, 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 all the time.
Good. Yeah. And we have this thing called a melisma. It doesn't show up in a whole lot of hymns. For example, all people that on earth do dwell, one syllable, one note. That's how Calvin liked it. That was dangerous enough. But this idea of a melisma, where you actually get, say, 4 notes to a single word or a single syllable, flying, that is, this is a dangerous business. You're actually just letting music take over there for a second. Music, as it were, takes flight. And we sort of watch music takes flight as we speak of flying. What else? Let's sing the first 2 phrases of this. I think we're all on the train here. Let's go ahead. The first 2 phrases again. Let's start right off. Crying, we presume they're not actually weeping. That is, they're crying out. This is the watchman's job. And we too have this big, throaty crying. I can't even sing the thing. Yes, but we cry as the watchmen cry. We have this big drop, big sort of dramatic thing that we do with our voices, just as the watchmen are doing this big dramatic thing with their voices. Right. Very rich stuff. I mean, by the end of the 16th century, there was no question you could do all kinds of things like this. And especially at the very beginning of the piece, that is to really engage you. Out of the depths, that is the very opening thing, could often be a colorful thing before you sort of get on with the business of singing the text. That is, it's often at the opening that we find the most dramatic kinds of text painting in this way. We're going to come back to this piece in a little. Let's look at something else. 51. this a Christmas tune. Let's sing the first verse in its entirety. A little more murky. Is there anything we can say in the way of sort of text painting being done here?
Well, I think gladly is the only.
Good. And what about gladly?
With the two quarter notes, or eighth notes and the quarter note. Boy, I haven't talked music for a long time.
Right. But there's a little more animation there than is really called for. The text didn't need that many notes. We just decided to write some animated music there, unaccountably animated. Why not?
Gladly. Because we're singing gladly.
Great.
So did the song, so what came first?
Oh, we're going to get there. That's a very good question. A question we'll tangle with. That is text or music, you mean?
Mm-hmm, because they're not by the same person.
Right.
Shema.
Yeah. This is a question, what is the next big question on our docket? Let's not go there just yet. What else about this piece? I mean, is there anything else that sort of ways in which music is...
Well, I just from the first note to the last note, it's incarnate because you start high from heaven and you kind of end up with singing on earth. You know, from
sing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, that's not quite the right note, but
yeah.
I mean, I think it is that. So you go from heaven to earth, from high to low.
I couldn't agree more. Sounds good to me. And of course, this sort of descending octave, da 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 da, some form of that is a final line, is a pretty off the rack gesture. This is how Infestivore ends too. Da 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 da. A Mighty Fortress Is Our God ends with the same kind of descent. But in that case, I don't think it counts, and in this case, I think it does. That is, we begin on a very high note. You could probably spend the next 10 minutes trying to find a piece that begins on its highest note in the LBW. Very, very, very few pieces do it. The great majority of pieces will find their highest note somewhere about three quarters of the way through them. This is kind of how things work. The idea of beginning on the very highest note, a very unusual gesture musically, and seems to be linked somehow with what's being talked about here. Something very high is coming down to something very low. And yes, that's accomplished dramatically in the very last phrase of this thing, but it's sort of accomplished throughout. We have to be aware of the height of that beginning, satisfied by the conclusion.
Yeah. Well, would another one be... Is that another one? Starts out high?
Sounds good to me. I've had the thought myself. Right, and then the way the major does exactly the same thing. Very interesting. Yeah, well, you're talking my language. That sounds good. You were say?
No.
Oh, sorry.
On hymns that are attempting to be representational, do they maintain that through subsequent verses?
Well, that's our second big question on the docket. Let's handle question number one first. And let's handle it with a little handout. What's coming around is a handout with a couple different things on it. I was trying to be economical here, pass them around. What comes first? Just the first verse of Wach auf. To get back to that thing, wake awake for night is flying. This hymn we just sang, any way to get one up there? I don't know. Wait, not in heaven above, but yeah, whatever. And here we have what Philip Nicolai actually wrote for Wake Awake for Night is Flying. We have enough handouts to go around. I've got plenty of these things.
We got enough.
Yeah.
Good. Here's what Philip Nicolai actually wrote, Wachet auf. Now we sing, wake awake for night is flying, a flying, the watchmen on the heights are crying. And we've talked about how wonderful that flying was. And we've talked about how wonderful that crying was. So what does Nicolai give us? Wachet auf. Oh, I'm sorry.
Number. Yeah, we don't have it on here.
Yeah. No matter what number is
you do, actually. That is the
text.
The text is all we're talking about.
Okay.
I'll see, we know the tune. Which is to say, Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme, der Wächter sein Hoch auf der Zinne. That's the tune we're talking about. Now, we had reveled in the joys of text painting in this tune. Tell me about text painting, Shay Philip Nicolai. How does the German actually go here? Somebody in the room speaks German better than me, probably.
I speak German.
Tell us about it. Can you get us these first two lines?
Wachet auf, ruf uns die Stimme. But I can't tell you what it means.
Okay.
I can read it, but yeah. I know certain words, but it's been a while since college, so.
Well, wake up, he cries. Wake up, calls to us the voice. Ruft uns die Stimme. Wake up, calls to us the voice. Der Wächter, der Hoch auf der Zinne. That is the watchman, very high on the pinnacle. That's as far as we've gotten in this text. Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Der Wächter, der Hoch auf der Zinne. So what gets painted there? What happened to flying? Flying wasn't there. That's Catherine Winkworth's idea. Catherine Winkworth, the late 19th century translator who translated all kinds of stuff. She was commissioned to do a translation of a major English hymnal and did it, and we're still living with many of her translations, which are terrific. But that flying, Winkworth made that up. I mean, all he says is, wake, awake, the voice is calling to us. And what happened to that crying that was so nice? We sang crying, and we felt so powerfully that we were crying along with the watchman, perhaps inhabiting the guise of the watchman as we do that crying. Well, that's not what he's got at all. I mean, what Philip Nicolai wrote was, you know, the watchman high, very high on the pinnacle. I mean, we don't have any way to sing it in English, but that's all he's saying. You know, we get the height of the pinnacle, that's sinna. That's the gag here. He's trying to sort of text paint his way into that pinnacle. But that's as far as Philip Nicolai goes. He didn't have any of this business about the flying in mind. He didn't have any of this business about the crying in mind. Those are all things that happened at the moment of translation. So, given that he wrote the text, and given that he wrote the tune, and that it's that what we've been talking about in connection with that tune has largely to do with accidents, are they fair? I mean, is it fair game? And do you all get the question? That is, that we talked about this tune and the richness of the text painting, then all of a sudden it turns out, well, no, that doesn't count. That just sort of happened by accident in the late 19th century, as opposed to the late 16th when it was written. What do we do with stuff like that? Does it still count, or is it somehow off limits? What do we think?
We learn association depending on our culture and how much we're exposed to it and how early. And I'm kind of, well, I haven't got a degree in it, but I work in a master's in ethnomusicology.
Yeah.
And it's quite different. I mean, you go to Nepal or you go to China or you know, I mean, each one of these countries has its own way of expressing these feelings. And so we make our association as we're taught to make.
Good. Okay. You're going to say. So for the last 125 years, there has been this document in the world, which is what we sang on page 31. Let's sort of turn back to it real quickly, just so we'll have this document vividly before our eyes. Page 31. For the last 120 years, whenever it was that Winkworth did her translating, it was earlier than that, 140 years, this document, the English document we sang, has existed. It did not exist before that. Catherine Winkworth translated this thing. But this is the document we grew up with. It is Catherine Winkworth's translation of Philip Nicolai's hymn. And this translation turns out to work, where text painting is concerned, in ways that Philip Nicolai never intended. Philip Nicolai, total authorship here, wrote words, wrote text, meant what he said. And what we're saying is no. By accident, 300 years after his death, somebody else can do the math, 250 years after his death or something, by accident, this translator came up with all these new meanings and now we're enjoying them. Is that okay or is this false somehow? What do we do with this?
We read the Bible the same way.
Okay. How so? I mean...
As I said earlier today, we are reading an Eastern book with Western eyes.
Yeah.
And we miss a lot of stuff in there. But we read other things in there that are meaningful for us.
Good. This is a wonderful observation. And the whole idea of seeking prefiguration, gestures of prefiguration in the Old Testament, trying to read the Psalms through a Christian lens and trying to get the Psalms to make Christian sense. Yeah, I mean, it has everything to do with just trying to get those old Hebrew things to sort of work in a Greek world or whatever. And we read things through different lenses all the time. Now, I guess the big picture issue for me here is that as a musicologist, I can't sweep minds with an answer like that. I mean, there's no musicologist worth anything who would publish a paper saying that a wonderful thing happened in a translation of La Boheme that wasn't there in the original. This just happened in the English by accident, but isn't it great? Nobody would talk about stuff like that. That's just embarrassing. That we obviously all know the original languages, we're intended to know the original languages we work in, and we care only about what authors had in mind. And if the author didn't mean it, who cares? We do not care about sort of translators and the vicissitudes of translation. So here, I'm afraid, we have to part ways with musicologists. We let musicologists set the agenda. We're concerning ourselves with a kind of musicological picture here, a musicological program in general, but we're going to have to part ways with them, because we're going to have to begin caring about things that a musicologist, as a sort of handler of texts, could not bring him or herself to care about.
Whatever. Do we know enough about how she worked to know whether when she did the translation she was concerned simply about kind of verbal rendering that was rhythmical, or whether something that the music painted, because she inherits the tune also.
Right.
So do we know enough about her compositional strategies to know whether she had tune in mind as well as text?
There is a lifeboat in my mind, a boat sailing away from me, the boat that contains all the responsible musicologists that are throwing this little sort of whatever lifeline out to me, which is the hope that Catherine Winkworth meant this.
But she might not have.
And my only conclusion is, if this is your question, did Winkworth actually author these meanings? My conclusion is no. I mean, that's so contrived. I mean, she had so many things to cover, and just trying to get this thing to scan. Wake Awake for Night is Flying, Watchmen on the Heights are Crying. I mean, she was doing hundreds of translations, and she had to work fast, and she had to sort of do the best job she could just to kind of get the meaning across. I cannot believe that she actually sat there thinking, now how am I going to get text painting to work even better than Nicolai got to work? It was just the last thing on her mind. Mm. I really think it was.
Mm-hmm. This Holy Spirit?
The Holy Spirit. Why the heck not? I think the Holy Spirit is a great idea. These things can happen by accident. And we simply have to accept it as, whether we say the Holy Spirit did it or not, he sort of took pen in hand, Winkworth's hand, and sort of made this happen. At least we can accept it as a gift and say, well, you just don't look a gift anything in the mouth, and you just sort of take these things as they come. And again, this isn't a musicological response. We have to say, we're just going to forget about all that. We're going to accept hymns for the kinds of documents that they are, which is to say documents that have been sort of shuffled and reshuffled and whatever. The same obviously pertains to hymns that were not originally matched with words and music the way we have them now. This is a conversation for a few days from now. I don't remember when. Tomorrow? Wednesday? Whenever it's coming along. We'll be dedicating an entire session to that issue. What happens when you have different tunes set to the same text or different texts with the same tune? Again, things happen. They often happen by accident. Now, real quickly, I wanted to point out another problem that we have in a piece like From All That Dwell Below the Skies. I think we have time to sing perhaps two verses of this thing. I want to sing the first and last verses of From All That Dwell Below the Skies, the thing that appears on your handout there below this Philip Nicolai piece. And this raises another important issue where hymns are concerned, where the whole text painting question is concerned. I'm sorry, I want to sing verses 1 and 2. So let's get to the end of the second verse. Here we go. Focus on one issue, and that's the point that the first thing out of our mouths is, From all that dwell below the skies, let the Creator's praise arise. That's right, we go down.
Yeah.
Does it work? No, it's a disaster. And from a text painting standpoint, obviously we're not dealing with a text painting. Whoever put this tune and text together had nothing in mind where this is concerned. That is that we're at our highest note from below, we're at our lowest note, second lowest note from for arise. It's a train wreck. This doesn't work at all where text painting is concerned. Yet, what do we do with that last phrase? Let's sing the last phrase of the second verse again. Till sun shall rise. Here we go.
Till sun shall rise.
And it's beautiful. We have the rise, the sopranos are up there on the D, the basses and tenors are doing there. Rise and set no more. It's beautiful. So what can we do? I mean, is it text painting or is it not? And, well, quick answer, what do we think?
But we sing this, we all know this melody.
Yeah.
And that's why it was in four parts.
Yeah. Yeah. And therefore...
It was written for another song originally.
Yes.
And does it word picture that one?
Some will be taken up in a couple days. Yes, whatever happens, happens by accident. I think we can almost certainly say that. But the fact that the first line doesn't give us anything, we don't have anything about Out of the Depths here, we have quite the opposite. That is, the line doesn't work as text painting at all, it fails. But that doesn't mean that by the time we get to the end of the second of four verses, and we get to this beautiful moment about the rise and set, that there can't be beauty there, there can't be text painting there, it just sort of jumps out and there it is. And there's no point in us saying, well, you know, there are rules about this, we have to either follow them or not. There are no rules. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. And this is what we have to kind of accept, that is, if we're willing to accept the whole premise, that hymns can occasionally be handled as things that do text painting. And this, to me, is kind of the essence of the question before us. Is it possible to speak of hymns as little operas, as little art songs, as little sort of oratorios, where text painting matters, where there's a close, meaningful correspondence between tune and text? And the answer would appear to be, sometimes. We can never tell when it's going to happen. It just happens sometimes. And when it does happen, well, there's the meaning. And when it doesn't happen, we can live without it. And this appears to be about as far as we can take these things. And it's not an especially satisfactory answer. That is, that we simply have to live, well, with the, I don't know, with the sort of limited scope of all of this. And I guess I would like to suggest very briefly, how much time do we have? Does somebody have a real watch on them?
It's a quarter to 12.
Right now, okay. Well, I want to suggest briefly that this may have something to do with the taking off of the shoes. That there are moments, you walk around all day long in the hot sand, brambles, whatever, and shoes are a very important life if you happen to live where Moses lives. That is, you don't want to feel the sand. You don't want to feel the ground under your feet. But every so often, something of importance happens. You're standing there in front of the burning bush, and he says, well, for goodness sake, feel it. Just give up on this idea that the quick and the dead, that your body and the sand are going to be sort of safely, securely separated from one another. Because every now and then something special happens, and you just have to allow the contact to take place. And this, to me, is exactly what we're talking about here. Text painting and music, connections, strong connections between text and tune, they don't happen all the time. You can never guess where they're going to happen, but where they're going to happen, just for goodness sake, take off your shoes. Just sort of enjoy the moment, let it occur, let this contact that we don't ordinarily take for granted, let this contact simply take place and enjoy for what it is. And with that, we'll close. Thank you.
Thank you.